watch it. Dr. Dobbs said it had cancer.
That's the best we can do. All right, I see I have a live mic now. You're all at my mercy. Okay, I'm here to talk about meme hacking for fun and profit, successful open source advocacy tactics. In order to properly tailor this talk to my audience, I need to ask a few questions first. First of all, how many of you have seen me give my roadshow before? Just a few of you. Good, fine. That means I get to recycle all my old jokes. how many of you would describe yourself as techies? Most of you. Okay, that's fine. How many of you would describe yourself as business people? Okay, fair number. Okay, those descriptions aren't necessarily exclusive. Okay, that's a good place to start. Successful open source advocacy tactics. I generally like to start this out by telling a bit of personal history, not so much because it's about me as because it's about how I achieved some enlightenment about these issues, basically by having my nose repeatedly rubbed in reality. So what put me on the path to talking about open source advocacy is, of course, the release of the Netscape code, what is now Mozilla, in January of 1998. And that is part of a longer story, which I hope most of you know, about the cathedral and the bazaar and all that stuff. But I'm not going to talk about that today. Instead, I'm going to describe to you the thought process that I went through after the release of the Netscape code. And it came as rather a shock to me, actually, in January 1998. I'm sitting there in front of my machine, hacking away at something, you know, fat, dumb, and happy. And I get this piece of mail that says, Eric, I think you better go look at this web page. They give me a URL. So I paste the URL into my browser, and Netscape, by the way, and I chase it, and it's a pointer to the original Netscape press release announcing that they're going to release the code that later became Mozilla. And as I'm reading that press release, large portions of it seem strangely familiar. As though somebody's taken my paper and run it through the marketing meat grinder. So my jaw is dropping further and further open, and finally I flip back to my mailer window and I send the guy a reply that says, yeah, it looks like somebody's been reading my paper, and I think I'll call Netscape up and find out what's going on here. And so I did that. I called Netscape, the main number, cold. I had actually known Jamie Zielinski for years before that, but we hadn't been in contact for a while, so I didn't know how to get in touch with him. So I called Netscape cold, and I spent about 15 minutes fighting my way through a bureaucratic phone maze. And eventually I reached something that seemed like it might be the voicemail box of an actual human being. And I left a message that basically amounted to, did I have something to do with this? And if I did, would somebody please tell me? And I hung up. And within an hour, I got a phone call from a nice woman named Roseanne Cena, who was a PR honcho at Netscape at the time. And she gave me a 20-minute pitch that boiled down to, yeah, you had something to do with this. All of our top guys read your paper, and they loved it. I'm going, and Jim Barksdale is out giving your name to national, our CEO is out giving your name to national press reporters right about now. And I'm going, and by the way, I think Jim wants to talk to you. And I'm going, I think I want to talk to him, too. Because it was immediately clear to me that, everything had changed. Sort of on a cultural level, in that potentially this was the big break in image that the open source culture had been waiting for 20 years. I mean, I was not quite a first generation Unix guy, but almost. I go back to the early 80s in that culture. And for many, many years, what had been holding us back from acceptance in throughout the business world wasn't that we didn't have better technology. We had better technology, and a lot of people knew that and used it for their most critical sites. We had a lot of people who were doing brilliant things, and we had high-quality software, better ways of doing things. And we kept having the crap kicked out of us by idiots with good marketing. And I saw immediately that that this release was potentially a way for us to turn that around, because for the first time in history, it was a Fortune 500 company, a darling of Wall Street, a technology bellwether, saying to the world, hey, you know, these scruffy hackers got something right. So the question I had to face was, what do we do next? This is a success. That's really interesting. We've never had a success before. We had a 20-year record of pretty nearly continuous failure. Okay? And the very fact that we had a success with the Netscape people taught me a couple of interesting things. And what I'm replaying for you now is the thinking I went through in the next 3 hours after that phone call, during which I did some of the hardest thinking of my life before or since. And I said, gee, maybe we can be forgiven for having been such complete abject failures at pushing our ideas out into the world, because we never saw what success looked like. And before I explain what success looked like, I need to explain the traditional Unix evangelism strategy that we had been using for many years. The traditional Unix evangelism strategy looks something like this. You are an engineer at some software company or other, or some outfit that uses software for critical enterprise functions, and you find out about some cool technology like, say, Linux or Emacs or the World Wide Web or something like that. And you get all excited about it, okay, and you think, wow, this is really great. This could solve a bunch of our business problems. It could lower our costs. It could raise our effectiveness. Now I've got to get everybody excited about it. So you go to all of your brother and sister engineers, and you say, wow, this is a cool technology. You should go take a look at it. And they all look at it, and they start jumping up and down, and they go, wow, this is a really cool technology. Now let's go persuade our first-line managers that this is a real cool technology. And you go to them, and you show them what it can do, and you show them what the potentials are, and what you hope is that they'll get really excited and start jumping up and down, and they'll evangelize the second-line managers, and the second-line managers will get really excited and start jumping up and down and evangelize the third-line managers, and enlightenment will trickle up the organization until it reaches the IT strategists at the top, who will then say, wow, we were completely wrong about our entire IT strategy, but now that you, the lowly engineers, have enlightened us, we'll change all of our business practices next week.
Amen.
Now, when I put it this way, it doesn't sound like it should work real well, does it? Okay? The traditional revolution from below evangelism strategy failed to work because of a basic fact about the dynamics of pyramidal authority hierarchies, the way most firms are set up. In any authority organization, there are three layers of people. There are the people at the bottom who do stuff. There are the people at the top who decide stuff and have the charter to change the direction of the organization if they need to. And there's a layer of people in the middle who are conservators of organizational stability. Conservators of organizational stability. That means it's their job to say no. It's their job to say no. So when you go to a middle manager with your exciting idea about how to revolutionize this or that piece of your corporation's operations and have lower costs and have huge benefits, and the middle manager says no, he's not being stupid, he's not being evil, he's doing his job. It's not it's not the middle manager's job to make fundamental changes in the logic of a business operation. That's the job of the people at the top. And this is what looking at the Netscape success taught us, because what happened in this case was no bottom-up evangelism. What happened was one guy at the top of the organization read my paper, had a moment of enlightenment, and then imposed that vision on everyone underneath him. So that's what success looks like. So this suggests that the winning evangelism strategy for open source and for Linux and for all these related ideas isn't bottom-up, it's top-down. Okay, reach the decision-makers, reach the strategists, reach the people with the power and the mandate to say yes. We'll get back to that in a moment, because there's another aspect of our traditional strategy that didn't work as well. I've talked about the Unix style of technology evangelism. Now let me talk about the free software style of technology evangelism, which consists of Richard Stallman, or someone very much like him, walking into a chief executive's office and saying, hi there, Mr. Chief Executive. You should use all free software for your key business functions because sharing is good and hoarding is evil. Now, when I put it that way, it doesn't sound like it should work very well, does it? Okay. In fact, if you make a pitch like that, sort of the most benign response you can expect is for the security guard to escort you out of the building. Okay. Now, why doesn't this work? This doesn't work because there's a fundamental mismatch between the language of the, quote, free software pitch and the language that the audience is prepared to hear. It isn't the chief executive's job to worry about moral abstractions like sharing. It isn't the chief executive's job to get lathered up in a fit of righteous outrage about the evils of software hoarding. The executive's job is to maximize value for his shareholders. And if you walk in there speaking a sort of abstract moral language, you're going to lose because you are not matching your language to what the audience is prepared to receive. Okay? So that's another thing that I learned from observing the happy accident of the cathedral and the bazaar sort of finding a receptor site in Barksdale's brain. When I thought about why that happened, I realized it was because implicitly, not explicitly, but implicitly in the cathedral and the bazaar, I had been making a business case for Linux. I had been making a business case for free software. We hadn't coined the term open source yet. I'll get to that. Okay? So I realized, quite accidentally, I didn't intend any of this. This was quantum fluctuationville. Okay? Quite accidentally, I had managed to do two things right that historically, when we tried to do evangelism for free software and for Unix and for related ideas, we had never gotten right before. One was going straight to the top, and the other was speaking the right language so that the people you were trying to evangelize could actually hear what you were saying instead of writing you off as a communist in Birkenstocks. What was that?
There are sandals.
Oh, okay. Well, fine. Okay. Anyway. Details.
That's a detail.
Yeah. So at that, having realized these things, I said to myself, how do we map out a strategy that will replicate the success that we had with the Netscape people and extend it to the rest of the technology industry and to the Fortune 500 and to mainstream computer business everywhere? Because, you see, I was worried after the release, because I realized that, in some sense, once the Netscape release happened, the destiny of our culture, as far as mainstream acceptance went, would be hanging by a thread for a while. Because if Netscape tried this and failed, then the response anybody would get any time in the next 15 years that they walked into an executive's office and said, you know, you should base a key part of your business strategy on, GCC, the response would probably be, well, you know, go away, kid, you bother me. Netscape tried that and they tanked. Okay? So we could actually have ended off worse off than before. So it seemed to me that what needed to happen was that we needed people out there who were telling a credible story in language that the business world could understand about why Netscape did what they did and why it was a good idea. And so at that point, I started ticking off in my head qualifications for an evangelist. Let's see, a person has to be, at least at the beginning, has to be not worrying about money a whole lot because the job isn't going to pay for a couple of years. So a person had better be pretty financially secure. A person has to have excellent speaking and writing skills. Person has to have some credibility with the press. Person should have done some of the basic research involved in explaining the method. Person needs to be an extrovert. And that's the point at which I went, oh, shit. Because, I love my tribe dearly, but we don't produce a lot of extroverts. And this job really demands somebody who can stand in front of 50 hostile reporters and readily cope. You know, that's not a matter of psychology so much as it is of basic brain chemistry. And if you don't have that genetic trait, you ain't gonna hack it real well. So that's the point at which I realized I was stuck with at least a significant part of the job for the foreseeable future, and I better learn how to do it properly. So that's how I started doing what I've been doing for the last 2 years, which is traveling around the world to business conferences and, you know, talking to Fortune 500 CEOs and technical groups and user groups and explaining how to propagate these ideas successfully. And I've already given you two of the high bits. One, go for the decision makers, go for the people with the power to say yes. And two, use language that's appropriate to your audience. The pitch that you want to make is by using open source software, you will increase your profits and reduce your risks. Okay? Learn the B school jargon. The business school jargon is important. It makes them think you're one of them, even if you're not wearing a suit. Okay, and I'll get to things like clothing later on. There are games you can play there, too. Yes, wear clothing. Wearing clothing is a good idea. But first, I want to bear down on the bit about reaching the people at the top. So this is the first thing I thought about. Okay, now if we have a premise that we need to reach the people at the top, the CIOs, the CEOs, the CTOs, how do we do that? Because we got a tactical problem here. Okay, the tactical problem is I don't play golf with Jack Welch. Okay, there ain't too many of us who are on a first name basis with Fortune 500 CEOs at the country club. We can't get at these people directly, and they're surrounded by layers of flappers. For any of you who've read Jonathan Swift, they're surrounded by layers of flappers whose purpose is to insulate them from all disturbing thoughts. Okay, so how do we reach these people? If we can't reach them directly, we got to find some other way to slip our LSD into their conceptual water supply. And I realized that there was at hand, there was an obvious way to do that. If we can't reach these people directly, what we need to do is co-opt the media from which they form their opinions. Okay? These people read newspapers, they read magazines. What we need to do, I realized, is create a cultural set, a cultural surround, a mindset in which the smart ones are looking at the open source thing and thinking, wow, this is the leading edge. I got to be there so I'm ahead of my competition. And the dumb ones are thinking, oh, everybody else is doing it, and I guess I should be too. Okay, so the strategy of going after the people at the top implies the tactic of going after the media that they read and saturating those media with pro-open source, pro-free software, pro-Linux memes. Okay? Everybody here know what a meme is? Anybody confused about that? Okay. A meme, it's a term that was coined by a biologist named Richard Dawkins in the late 70s. It's by analogy with a gene, which is a sort of unit of biological inheritance that transmits itself through organisms. A meme is an infectious idea that transmits itself by replicating in people's brains and then inducing them to hand it to other people. So we wanted to flood the world with pro-open source memes through the media so that the brains of these executives would be simmering in a medium that would predispose them to do what we want. Okay? So then I thought about, okay, media, what media? And the next thing I realized was computer magazines, technical journals? No, these do not matter. They are irrelevant. Why are they irrelevant? Well, because the people we want to reach don't read them. They leave reading computer magazines to underlings. The people we want to read to reach are reading the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, The Economist, Forbes, and Barron. Okay, I probably should have included Business Week at the time, but that was my original five. So these are the media from which the key strategists in the Fortune 500 form their opinions. Those are the media we need to go after. Now, why did I say Fortune 500 just now? Okay, remember, the objective here is victory. Okay. If we want the software industry to change its practices, the way to do that is by changing the demand picture they're seeing from their most important customers. Okay? And that implies the Fortune 500, because while the Fortune 500 ain't necessarily the biggest market, it's the most concentrated. It's the biggest market you can address with a single product line, with a single marketing strategy. And in general, when the Fortune 500 says frog, the software companies hop. All right? So the strategy was to get to these critical people at the top of the Fortune 500 through their media, change the demand that they're putting out so it goes from demanding, from accepting closed source to demanding open source, and in that way we win. Okay, all of these were things I thought about in those first few hours, and I basically spent the next 2 years executing that. But there was one thing that came after that, which is the term open source. And here's where we get back to the issue about using the right kind of language. Okay? When you say free software to your typical executive, what do you think goes on in that executive's brain pan?
No money.
Yeah. No money, no profit, no business, and I look really bad on the next quarterly report. Okay? All right? Yeah, that's what you get if you're lucky. If you're not lucky, the response you get is, free software. That have something to do with that anarchist in Boston. either way, you're basically screwed before you start. You know, forget it. The rest of your conversation with Mr. Executive is not going to go well. So I realized that one of the things we needed was to rebrand the product. I'm using marketing lingo. Be afraid. Be very afraid. We needed to rebrand the product in a way that was less frightening to the target audience. And okay, I'm going to ask all of you to brace yourselves hard and cope with the fact that I am talking about marketing. Because that's what we're talking about here. One of the things techies and hackers have a lot of trouble getting used to is the idea that in the real world, image counts for more than substance. Cope with that, because if you don't understand that, you're going to lose to people who do. Okay? So I am talking about marketing tactics. I am talking about spin. I am talking not about lying. I'm talking about telling the truth in an effective way. We were stuck with telling the truth in real ineffective ways for a long time. Okay? And the label free software was part of that. Now, I'm not here to be in an argument with anybody about the ethical ideas behind free software. That's irrelevant. Maybe I believe in those ideas, maybe I don't. Doesn't matter. The question is, what kind of language, what kind of message, what kind of communication gets us the results we want? All right? And that's why a few months after the Netscape release, when I came out to Mountain View to consult with Netscape, help them formulate a strategy for what later became the Mozilla organization, I got together with a few key people in the Silicon Valley Linux circles, and we had a little meeting, and the topic of the meeting was, how do we follow up on this success? We've had a breakthrough here. How do we exploit it? Because there was every possibility that the whole Netscape thing could turn out to be a flash in the pan. It could turn out to be perceived as a sort of weird one-off that nobody had any incentive to repeat. So how do we follow up on this? And one of the things I brought up at the meeting was that I thought that the term free software, regardless of what you thought about the ethics behind it, in a marketing sense, sorry, it's the M word again, in a marketing sense, it was a millstone around our necks. So we needed to come up with something better. So we sat around a table and brainstormed for quite a while. And eventually, a woman named Chris Peterson of the Foresight Institute, they're a think tank in Palo Alto that thinks about nanotechnology and the future, she came up with the term open source, and we sort of listened to that and went, wow, that sounds like a winner. It even had a previous meaning that was helpful. Most people don't know this now, but open source is a term of art in spook circles. People who do intelligence for a living talk about open sources and secret sources. And an open source is something like an encyclopedia or a map or a newspaper that's published by the country you're studying, okay, that you have open access to. And that's actually helpful to that meaning was actually helpful to what we were trying to do. So we came up with this term, and we realized the next thing we need to do is we need to sell this term and the sort of mindset that goes with it that says we're going to do effective marketing to the community at large. Okay, so the next step after that was in, I think it was late April of 98, when Tim, bless his heart, convened the first open source summit conference in San Jose. And we got together a bunch of community leaders, and we talked about a lot of things. And one of the things I did was I presented a pitch that we needed to be rebranding ourselves in this way. And they thought about it, and they talked about it, and they bought it. And that's why a lot of leaders in the community started using the phrase open source at around the same time. And at the same time, we put out mail, and we talked in news groups, and we said we'd like everybody to start talking about open source. And here's why: because we want to present a message that the corporate world can actually hear. And I learned from the subsequent reaction that there had to have been a lot of pent-up demand for a less confrontational way of describing what we were doing, because the whole culture basically went from majority use of the term free software to majority use of the term open source in about 6 weeks flat. The speed just astonished me. And so we over the following year, we used that marketing tool, and an amazing thing happened. A lot of the same magazines and journalists and analysts who had previously been really disparaging about free software were suddenly falling all over themselves to say nice things about open source. And you know, it was the same software. It was the same people. It was the same technology, but different words. Image matters. Image really matters. That's the most painful lesson for me of the last 3 years, okay? And it's ugly, and we may not like it as techies, but if we don't learn it, we lose. Okay? Now we're winning, and I want us to keep winning, because at deep down, that was what was motivating me. I'd been a Unix guy for 20 years, and God damn, I was tired of losing. So this is the beginning of how to win, okay? Which is to remember, always address your audience in language they can understand. When you're talking to business people, speak the language of business. And I'll get more specific about that in a moment. The language of business, I'll get more specific about it now. Duh. The language of business is about profits, and it's about control, and it's about minimizing risk. And the further up you go in the corporate hierarchy, the less and less it gets to be about money, and more it gets to be about risk control. If you're an ordinary line manager, say a product manager, okay, then yeah, you're worrying about revenue a lot, okay? But if you're a vice president or a chief executive officer, what you're worrying about most is risk. Okay, the risk that you'll be blindsided by a technological change you didn't anticipate. The risk that a competitor will trump you in some crucial market. The risk that employees who are key to your whole effort will decide they can get a better deal with your competitors. Okay, executives at the middle and near the bottom of organizations obsess about money. Okay, executives near the top obsess about risk. So that means it follows as the night to day that the key open source pitch has to be about reducing your risk. About reducing your risk and controlling against the possibility of bad outcomes. Okay? Remember, executives, a lot of them are fundamentally sort of conservative personalities. They're primates like the rest of us. They're driven by fear and greed. Okay? If you want to get them to change your behavior, you have to their behavior, you have to appeal to fear and greed. And of the two, fear is more powerful, actually, okay, because it's survival. So what you want to do is you want to, in order to make the open source pitch effective, you need to show executives that by sticking with closed source solutions, they are taking a dangerous and unnecessary risk. Okay, that's the pitch you need to make. And the way you can do that, for example, is by pointing out Gee, Mr. Executive, when you buy a closed source solution from a single vendor, you're making your business dependent on that vendor, because by definition, there's only one agency that can fix your software, that can extend your software, that can respond to problem reports. And if they decide that they don't need you as much as you need them, you're kind of screwed. And in fact, what's going to happen over time if you go with a closed source solution is the vendor's incentive is always to raise prices and to lock you in harder, because they've got control. You can't even see inside your software. You can't, let alone modify it. They've got control of your business. Okay? When I guarantee you, when you say to a founder CEO, they've got control of your business, I guarantee you he's going to listen. I guarantee you that's going to bring him up short. Okay? So now, having aroused the fear response, okay, you need to soothe it away. Okay? And the way you do that is by pointing out, on the other hand, if you go with open source, okay, now you own the sources, you own the software, and nobody can take it away from you. Listen to the way I said that. You own the software and nobody can take it away from you. You have control. Your risk just dropped. Don't you feel better now? Ah. Okay? And instead of being in a monopoly situation where you're on the wrong end of a supplier monopoly and prices are always going to go up, you're now in a situation where multiple service companies will be competing to get your business. And you can play them off against each other, which means you get lower prices and more control. And if none of them satisfy you, you can hire a bunch of programmers and take your maintenance in-house. Any way you slice it, it means you have control of your business again. That's the pitch that will get open source software adopted in critical places. So now I've more or less come to the end of my pre-prepared rant, and we can workshop the rest of this. I'll take questions, and maybe that'll suggest further places we can go.
It seemed like the first part of your pitch to the executive was aimed at telling them to use open source software.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part of your pitch was saying that they should make their software open source to the world.
No, so far I've completely been talking about the demand side, that is software consumers. There's a different pitch that you make to software producers. Okay, if there's nothing more immediate we need to go into, I'll go into that in a moment. But let me take a couple more questions first.
Well, that's exactly where I wanted to go. It is a very different story. The whole discussion in terms of the very choice of the words open source really conveys, I think, again, that sense of risk. It makes sense when you talk about the story of how the term was chosen, the viewpoint, the perspective. It does not say for people that wish to produce open source software, it does not give an image of business models and revenue models that surround that. I mean, there's an idea that you sell service, but what I would like to go towards is a discussion of how you create chains of value where you as a developer of software become locked in to delivering business needs.
I thought this was supposed to be an advocacy talk, not an economics talk. I mean, I'll do that if that's what people are interested in.
Yeah.
But let me take a couple... Is that where everybody wants to go with this? Back there.
Question about I work in a national laboratory, and I've been interested in the government model, and it seems like you're going to talk to the government, it has to be a whole different story.
Mm-hmm.
So I've often wondered, it would be great from my perspective if we could somehow convince government procurement.
Okay, here's a government procurement argument.
Let me say one word, and that's just open document.
Right. Here's a government procurement argument. At least in the U.S. government, a government agencies at all levels have a constitutional and often a statutory obligation to be transparent to citizen inquiries unless there's a compelling reason to do otherwise. So open source software at all levels of government is an extension of the principle of freedom of information, that citizens should be able to inquire into the mechanics and the proceedings of their government. So that's an argument that you can make. That one turns out to be especially effective at like municipal government level and state government level. That open source software is a sunshine play. It's a way to make government more transparent. Is that responsive to what you were after? Back there in the... Okay.
However, the CIO is very responsive to a security.
Ah, let's talk about security. Yeah, this is one of the questions that anxious CEOs often ask. But if we had opened up our source, won't we get cracked a whole lot? Won't it make it easy for the crackers? Now, there's several ways you can approach this. One way, if you're dealing with a relatively intelligent executive, is to point out the analogy of cryptography. Okay? Cryptographers have known for over 15 years that closed source is simply not reliable, that you have to peer review a cryptographic technique in open source before it can be considered reliable enough to be used in a real-world security system. Okay? But if your executive isn't receptive to that kind of academic argument, there's a soundbite you can trot out, which is, closed source means only the bad guys get to see the bugs. Okay? Because in general, the bad guys have a stronger incentive to find the bugs than the good guys do. So if you close the source, only the bad guys get to see the bugs. If you open the source, both the bad guys and the good guys get to see the bugs, and then the good guys get to fix them. Okay? So that's the soundbite version of the security discussion. And if you want to go deeper than that, as I said, go with the analogy to cryptography and point out that 100 years ago, military cryptographers know that if you depend on the secrecy of your algorithms, this was before computers, they figured this out, if you depend on the secrecy of your algorithms, you're much less secure than if you're only depending on the secrecy of your keys. Because keys are smaller bits of information. They're much easier to defend. They're much easier to keep secret. They're much less likely to leak. It's hard to keep the internals of your programming systems from leaking out because people have to use them constantly. They get exposure. But it's relatively easy to keep secret keys from leaking out. So for security, you want a system that doesn't depend on the security of your algorithms, depends only on the keys, and you force yourself to play well that way by opening up the source to the security system. Yes?
I think this may, may be irrelevant to what you're doing, but I have a quibble about meaning versus language.
Yeah.
Isn't what Stalin's saying in his Birkenstocks different semantically than what you're saying for the executive? I mean, it's not just a difference in language.
Of course it is.
So it's not the language he's using, it's what he's saying.
Yeah, what he's saying cannot be heard by those people, and when it is heard, it arouses hostility and fear. Okay, it's just reality, whether you agree with it or not. Yeah.
I work in the medium, and a lot of what you say is very refreshing. A lot of open source tends to be very hostile to marketing and PR.
With some reason.
Yes, with some reason, and also, quite frankly, very infantile, really, not very sophisticated about the needs for marketing and PR.
Mm-hmm.
But in your presentation, I mean, a lot of it sounds very good, but on the other hand, you're competing against corporations that have big budgets,
mm-hmm.
send out glossy press kits
mm-hmm.
that schmooze with the media, and what are your kind of recommendations for the fact that at least at the level of sheer finance, the open source community is heavily outgunned
right.
by the Microsofts and the Oracles.
Doesn't seem to have done them much good, does it?
No.
Their theoretical monetary advantage hasn't turned into much leverage. The key advantage we have is that we're actually telling the truth. Not an advantage to be underestimated. I mean, we can back up our brag with things like mean time between failure statistics that none of our competition can match. So the recipe from that is to be aware that you have to be artful, be aware that you have to use language cleverly, be aware that you have to match your language to your audience, but never, ever tell a lie. Never, ever do that. Because if you do that, there's two levels of problems here. Okay, one is that if you tell a lie, you're likely to get caught in it. Okay, the other point is that human beings are really quite good at detecting lying. They're quite good at detecting insincerity, and often they hide that knowledge from themselves, but it unconsciously affects their behavior. Okay, if you get in the habit of saying things that you don't believe and know are true, it's going to sort of leak through in your body language and half poison your dealings with the people you're trying to persuade. Okay, which brings up an important issue. Here's another chronic problem that hackers have in dealing with typical executives. We have an ingrained cultural prejudice that business people are stupid. Okay, we need to get rid of this prejudice. There are a couple of reasons to get rid of this prejudice. One reason is it's not true. Okay? Business people are not stupid. They're simply trained and wired for solving a different class of optimization problems than we are. Okay? The techie people in this room couldn't do what a typical chief executive does every day. Meet a payroll, deal with endless political hassles, you know, deal with regulatory, oh God, that's a nightmare all by itself. Deal with all that crap, okay? Your typical techie could do that. The personality type just isn't right for it, okay? So you got to start thinking of business people not as being stupid, because they aren't, but as being trained to solve a different problem, okay? If it helps, think of them as being differently abled. Okay. But there's a second reason to get rid of this prejudice that business people are stupid. Besides the fact that it's not true, there's this problem of your body language leaking what you really think when you deal with these people. And if you walk in with the preconception that Mr. Executive is stupid or wrong because he engages in hoarding, okay, even if you make the sweetest possible pitch to that executive, Your basic contempt is going to leak through in your body language, and it's going to poison the transaction, and it's not going to go well, and neither of you is ever really going to understand why. Okay? And that's going to keep happening until you learn to actually respect the people you're making your pitch to. So I think that ties into some of the things you were talking about. So that's actually three things. Okay, go for the people at the top, tune your language properly. Okay, four things, four main weapons. Always tell the truth, and remember that business people are not stupid; they're just different. Okay, and actually, this is probably a good time to talk about presentation style, since we're bordering on that now. Don't wear a suit. Don't do it. There are people who will tell you that you should, okay? The problem is that if your typical techie wears a suit, what he looks like is like he's doing a bad imitation of a business person. Okay? This is not what you want to do, because if you do a bad image of imitation of a business person, what the executive's going to pick up is that this guy's trying to play in our world by our rules, and he's lousy at it, so we'll just ignore him. We'll write him off. Okay, so lesson one. Don't wear a suit. Do dress neatly, okay? You want what you're wearing to convey the message that I know how to play the dress for success game, and I could if I wanted to, but I don't have to. Okay? You want to present yourself essentially as an equal in a different hierarchy, a prince from another country. You laugh, but I'm not joking. Where I got the Prince from Another Country riff, by the way, is from a science fiction writer named Norman Spinrad. science fiction writers, the role he played was, I'm a screenwriter in Hollywood and I have all these connections out there, okay? And, you know, people would have this response to him that, you're a really cool person because you have high status in this hierarchy that I barely understand, okay? When he was in Hollywood, the game he would talk was, well, I'm a science fiction writer and I know all the science fiction writers. And the response he'd get again is, wow, you must be a cool person because you have high status in a hierarchy I don't understand. So you want to be the prince from another country, okay? Good tactic for this. Take a look at what I'm wearing. Okay. How many of you have seen sneakers or hackers or the net? Okay. Observe something. I am not dressed like a real life hacker. I am dressed like a hacker in the movies. There's a reason for this. Because your executive's image of what a hacker is like is more than likely to have been shaped by one of these dumb damn movies. Okay? Make that work for you. So that's a bit about personal style and presentation. Don't wear a suit. Do be the prince from another country. Do dress neatly. You know, and for more, you know, go to some outfit like Toastmasters International that I found out later will teach you all the stuff I had to learn by myself to learn how to do effective speaking and personal presentation and body language. A source I recommend, if you find yourself doing a lot of public speaking and presentation, I learned a lot of what I know about it by watching stand-up comics. Okay? These people, now, some of the moves I've been doing will make more sense now, the body language and the timing. Okay? These people are the masters of working a crowd. They are the masters of one-to-many communication. Robin Williams or Stephen Wright can out-communicate any politician or TV evangelist who's ever lived. Okay? So go study these people. Watch what they do. Watch their timing. Watch how they interact with an audience. Okay? If you have to do public speaking, those are the people we'll learn from. So I'll take some more questions now. Right back there in the blue.
I'm wondering if you'd like to extend it to somebody in the position of selling open source. They're with the company and they're trying to market open source to other people. Some of them like the open source, some of them like the art. How would your message change there? If it would.
In general, the more techy your audience is, the more you can focus on the direct technology benefits of open source, the peer review story, okay? Are you all familiar with the peer review wrap? Shall I do a version of that here for you to take away? I see some people are, some people aren't. The analogy to make, especially in a context like you're describing, is to point out the similarity between what open source programmers are learning to do now and what we have traditionally done in other branches of engineering where reliability is historically high. Okay? Yeah, he got it. Okay? We know how to, we have a set of institutionalized practices for how to do things like building suspension bridges and skyscrapers. Okay? One of the ways we do that, one of the ways that we hedge against the risk that human beings will fuck up, okay, is by institutionalizing peer review. Before you get to string wire or pour concrete, your blueprints are going to go to a group of reviewing engineers who are experts in your field, who are not affiliated with the original design group, and their job is to go through all of your calculations and your blueprints and make sure you didn't mess up. And if you did mess up, to catch it and point you where you have to correct it. So in other branches of engineering, we have open source. Okay? In experimental science, if you're a physicist or a biologist, if you have a theory about meson decay or the sex life of salamanders, okay, you can publish that, but it doesn't get accepted as part of what other people build on until it's been reviewed by skeptical peers. Okay, this is the way we found over the last 400 years to institutionalize against hedging against the risk of human failure. So in other branches of engineering, where we do peer review, we get high reliability. Now we look at software. In the one area where we've done systematic peer review for 30 years, which is the internet infrastructure, we have 99% reliability. The core internet hasn't had a serious crash since the early 1980s. Okay? Everywhere else in software, where we don't do a peer review, where the source is closed, our reliability sucks. Coincidence? I think not. Okay? So that's a good story to tell. That's a good story to tell. Point out the analogy between open source and successful peer review practices in other branches of engineering. Is that responsive to your question?
Yes, thank you.
Good. Next, yeah.
I think another situation, marketing within an organization, where you might want to try to encourage adoption by one department or in a state government by one agency, there's a fear that people have of being the first one.
Right.
Even if you can convince them it's a good idea, it's too risky, I don't want to be the first to adopt.
Right.
Do you have any strategies for that?
Oh, yeah, there's an excellent counter strategy to that. If you don't go first, your competitors will, and they'll eat your lunch. Okay?
Even internally?
Yes. Remember, use fear. Fear is your friend. Okay?
Politics always fun.
Oh, yes, yes. This works particularly well when the organization's facing some kind of external competitive threat, but it can work for internal competition as well. Because if you can get them as far as recognizing that there's a theoretical advantage to open source that they ought to be able to reap, but they're going, I don't want to be first, the nightmare scenario you want to bring up is, what if someone else goes first? You lose. Okay? And there are variations you can work on that, such as pointing out that if your firm is not the first to go open source in a particular niche in the software market, they may find that all the good developers have been co-opted by somebody else who got there earlier. Okay? The supply of developers is finite. If you co-opt all the good ones into your community and cultivate some loyalty, the second people to show up aren't going to get much. So that's a variation on the fear that your competitors will get first, that you can get there first, that you can play. Yeah. Oh, is this my 10-minute warning? Oh, I'm sorry. So I guess I'll take one more question and then shut up. Yes.
How would you, it seems like now people have gotten the message to some degree about open source. If you're in a project that is new to open source or something like that, can you just piggyback on the success of Linux and say, hey, you know, this is the Linux of X, and don't you want to get with the program?
Good tactic. Always associate yourself with success. You'll get further that way. All right. Well, thank you for listening, everybody.